Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and I'm joined again today by new metal enthusiast and the co-host of the Double Density podcast, Brian Hasty. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Rob. Though I feel like right off the top, I should say you kind of brought me in as a ringer for this episode.
I mean, the thing is, I've heard you talk about the Place Bonaventure hotel incident before, but I've never heard you talk about it really on a pod and in depth in any kind of way. And I felt like, yeah, this initially started as, hey, let's talk about this weird abduction case from this involving this Canadian band. And it evolved into, let's talk about the Place Bonaventure hotel, because it just seems like it's a big case that most people don't know about because it was in Montreal in 1990.
Yeah, it is. It is a bit of a weird case in that, like most cases, you have like one to like four-ish, let's say, like witnesses. Whereas, like, this was easily seen by 30 to 40 people at the height of the issue. So before I forget, some local flavoring, right? So in English, mm-hmm. we call these objects UFOs, but in French, they're called ovnis, which means objet volant non identifié, which is obviously UFO. So that was something to note at the top. And I realized I want to use another Canadian adage in that, like, I feel like when we get together, it's kind of like listening to a hockey broadcast. Rob, you're the play-by-play man. I'm the color commentary. Together, mm-hmm. we form great UFO harmony in our lives.
Absolutely. We present a complete picture here. And honestly, I think any sports broadcasters out there should feel a little concerned, because we are coming for their jobs in you know, later 2022. We are this dynamic duo of strange UFO stories. So, Brian, give us a little flavoring for the time period of 1990. What is 1990s Montreal like?
It's a city in expansion, which is kind of interesting, right? So the downtown core is seeing a revitalization. And we'll touch on this in a bit, but one of the big construction projects is Mille de la Gauchetière, which is a high rise, which actually currently has like an indoor skating rink, like an ice skating rink you can go into if you really feel the desire to go to. There's a bunch of businesses and then condos at the top few floors. Montreal really comes into its own during that period commercially, and then we'll see a steady decline throughout the mid and late 90s as a number of factors kind of lead businesses to leave Montreal. One of the bigger things, of course, is the 1995 referendum on the sovereignty of Quebec. So that's kind of the apex of businesses moving their headquarters outside of Quebec into other parts of Canada. So there is a bit of like linguistic flight going on there. But 1990 Montreal, kind of tough. The biker wars will heat up in a couple of years, but the ground is being laid there too.
Yes, we are like in that beginning period where, you know, cigarettes are going to become an issue here. They were especially an issue over on the New York side too, because it was like you couldn't escape it. Like it was this big deal that, you know, George Pataki tried to make even bigger than it really was. But, you know.
Yeah, so running cigs from the Canadian side to the American side with like fake seals and stuff was definitely a thing that took center stage here in Quebec too. Because, like, I mean, like, Quebec is a very corrupt province, right? Like, there was the Charbonneau Commission about 10 years ago, which outlined the intersection of construction projects in Quebec with the mafia and how widespread mm-hmm. that was. And so, like, officers being on the take even during the biker wars was also a thing.
Which is, yeah, just, we're setting the stage here, folks. We are setting the stage for really what I've come to call the it's like the Chicago O'Hare UFO incident, but on steroids, because it's a bigger UFO and it hangs around for a lot longer. Place Bonaventure, is it still a Hilton hotel?
Yes. So it's still a Hilton. It is located sort of like on the southern side of the downtown core. And what happens is that the, because Montreal is an island and in the middle of it, there's Mount Royal and everything kind of descends from there. So one of the plateaus that kind of envelops the downtown core kind of slopes down afterwards, and Place Bonaventure is sort of like on the edge of that. So it kind of overlooks like a lower altitude, kind of like little plain almost.
Yes. And infamously, this hotel has a pool on the roof that people were swimming in November.
Yeah. So but something to note is that there was a heated section of the pool.
Yes. Yes, so, absolutely.
So these people aren't like the Polar Bear Club kind of people who are just jumping for joy at the sight of ice and water commingling.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But like this incident is really that quintessential incident that you hear people talk about, like, well, why do we see like big UFOs hanging out over cities? And, you know, like it's stuff like that. This is one of those cases. Like, this is literally one of those kind of like home run cases in which a UFO does do that. Although, you know, in some eyes, that could be ice particles and other BS.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a bit. There's some like theories behind it, but to set the stage, right? First things first, November 7th, 1990, around 7:30. A bunch of people are out enjoying the outdoor heated pool at Place Bonaventure, the Hilton, and suddenly they look up, Rob, and what do they see?
They see a big old UFO just like hanging out there. It's like, it's big, it's round. It's got some like lights coming off this thing, like multiple different lights, like light streams. And they get very specific in the investigation of this case in like laying out almost how this craft has to be angled for like these light beams to be seen by so many people. But, you know, some people said that they saw four, some said six, some said even more than that. But like, we're talking about a big old UFO. The sun had set by about 4:30 that night. So we're into the winter months. It's getting cold out. The sun is setting much earlier. And interestingly enough, it's an American tourist that first sees this UFO on this roof in this pool.
Yeah. So she is alerted to this. She looks up. She sees it. She tells the lifeguard, who then does two very interesting things. Firstly, calls the cops, sure, but then also calls the La Presse newspaper. So the offices of La Presse were located in Old Montreal, which is about a 20 to 25 minute walk from the hotel, all things considered, depending on the weather. And so all these people start gathering on the rooftop, including the local cops from Station 22, as well as La Presse newspaper reporter, who also then calls other La Presse newspaper reporters, and one of them takes a picture of the incident.
Yes. So like the first person that arrives, I believe, is Albert Sterling. And like this is like 20 minutes after the lifeguard reports this and, you know, just shows up. He's like, hey, whoa, there's a UFO right there. And then they like this becomes an episode of like phone tag of people calling just everybody that they can. So at 7:38, after he'd been there for you know, just for a few minutes, he telephones the Montreal Urban Community Police, Station 25, like you mentioned, and he starts to report what he says is fallen debris that's coming from the sky from like a satellite or a space object or something like that. The only problem is there's nothing falling. It's just there
sitting
in the sky.
Yeah, just sitting.
Yeah. So, you know, he also contacts the international airport and he can't get through. It's the line's busy at the time, but like, yeah, the lifeguard contacts the press. Like, it just becomes like this big, huge kind of, let's get everybody that we can up here to see this thing. And, you know, this object was situated over the southeast corner of the pool. But the thing is like, if you see like estimates of the size of this thing, there's one particular image. This thing is like at least 1,000 feet wide from estimates, and like,
yeah, it is quite large.
Yeah, it is absolutely huge. It's hanging out over this pool, and you know, we're getting into like multiple eyewitnesses. It just seemed like at a certain point the lifeguard just like leaves her post and just starts having a bunch of people come out on the roof. It's amazing.
Yeah. So eventually, though, they do reach. So there are two airports at the time. Now there's only one, but they reach Dorval, which is a 25 minute drive from the like west from the downtown core, as well as Mirabel, which is actually located off the island to the north a bit. And neither of them report anything at the time.
Yeah, nothing. There is nothing registering on radar. And from what we later find out through the investigation, like the only way to evade radar in this particular area is if something is flying below, I think, 450 feet or something like that. So and estimates put this thing at an elevation of like about 6,000 feet or so. So,
yeah, it is quite high.
Yeah, so should be showing up on radar. It isn't. And just given the size of this thing, and even from, you know, 6,000 feet, you could pretty much tell that it's ginormous. So at 8 o'clock, Marcel LaRoche of La Presse steps foot on the rooftop. And then 10 minutes later, F. Lippi, who is an officer with the MCUP, he steps out as well. And Lippi he describes seeing these yellow lights. They're all like singular beams and they're emanating from all over the place on from this object. But what's interesting is when he's up there and when the amount of witnesses that they had up there at that time, there was a Cessna type aircraft that was flying at about 1200 feet. It flew underneath this craft and, you know, against this like huge yellow circular backdrop, this plane was like tiny in comparison to the object above it. So we have more journalists. Jules Belvaux, he ended up receiving a letter from a man named Francois, I don't even know how to pronounce that last name, Cheverfils or something like that, but he claimed to know a friend who, known only as Mr. Jean, that he saw an object from his plane between 7:30 and 8 p.m. So we kind of have confirmation that this is the guy that flew underneath this object.
Yeah.
The story progresses and there's a woman and her daughter driving on Champlain Boulevard.
So here's the confusing thing. So I looked around and there are four possible Champlain Boulevards in Montreal that could be. So I'm not quite sure which one it is. There's one in the neighborhood I used to live in that has a clear shot at looking at the downtown core. So I think it might be that one.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. So this woman and her daughter, it was about 8:15, they observed, quote, two large white spots of light in the sky, along with a number of smaller lights, which did not appear to move and were silent. The sighting allegedly took place 4.2 miles southwest of Place Bonaventure. So we have, you know, corroborating sightings a little away from the building. And, you know, we start to see police backup arrive at about 8:20. And like, what do you do if you're a police officer? You're showing up and, you know, the police are then calling the RCMP, asking for backup from them. What the hell do you do at the top of this roof looking at this UFO? Like, what is the police going to do?
I think one of the cops even jokes that he's like, should I shoot at it?
Yes.
I think he tells that to one of the reporters, too, at one point. And also, just to note, so around the downtown core, there is also a place called Place Ville-Marie, which has spotlights and beacons, and you can see it pretty much from like anywhere in the city on the south side of the mountain. This is not that either. This is a clear object that sustains because the beacons swirl around in the city. So that is not this. This is an immobile object that sits.
Yes. And it's by 8:50, around 8:52 that we get confirmation that this thing is not registering on radar at all. And, you know, it's starting to veer into like 2 hours that this object has just been hanging out here above this roof. And LaRoche at this time, a reporter from La Presse, he decides he's going to run downstairs and he's going to grab a camera. Now, he's not a professional photographer. You know, as a journalist, he probably just usually takes pictures of, you know, the people that he's interviewing for whatever article that he's writing about. But he starts to, you know, try and snap a few pictures of this thing. He seems to have some trouble with it. So he calls the photographer of La Presse, who gives him, you know, a couple of pointers, and he snaps a couple of photos that are pretty interesting. One of which definitely shows like something round with like lights coming from it. You know, it's interesting. It's yellowish, and I don't know. What do you think of the photo?
It is of poor quality, Rob.
Yeah, it is very poor quality. Absolutely.
I mean, the thing is, you can kind of see the outline of the hotel, sort of, but then in the sky, there's just an object. But you can't really make out the number of light points either, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately not. But, I mean, it's an interesting photograph in the very least, because it's just like, well, how the hell do you photograph something like that with the lighting conditions that you're given? It's a tough thing. So, you know, around 9 o'clock, we have more backup from the MCUP arriving. We have an investigator with the RCMP is now on the roof. LaRoche takes like several photographs between 9 o'clock and 9:05. And throughout the hour, more and more personnel just arrives. Like,
it's a pool party.
Yeah, it really is a pool party. So, you know, at one point, the police officers get in touch with the construction crew working on
Mild Legoshensei, which I was talking about before. Yeah, which is just being constructed at that point.
Yeah, and they end up having the lights on the construction towers turned off. And even after that, that object was still there. So,
and I've seen certain skeptics say that, like, oh, it's just lights from the construction site, ignoring the fact that for the last half of this encounter, they were off.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like, how do you explain how that happens when they do shut off the lights and it's still there? So, yeah, another thing for... I have a question, because like this is the case not only in this incident, but also in the Carp Guardian case. Why is the skeptic always just the huge looking nerd every time?
Are you talking about the Mark Gelina guy from our Environment Canada?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm hoping this makes it into the show notes, but I sent you a CBC Archives video from 94 where they did a whole package on this. And like, if I were to describe like Montreal in the 90s, it'd be all of these people together. They all have like weird pastel colored suits. It's all ill fitting. And then Rob, you made one of my favorite comments of all time.
Yeah. You said ill fitting. And I said, like, you mean like, are we talking David Byrne or...
Yeah, absolutely. Stop making sense, David Byrne. And then also you made the comment about the reporter smoking in the newsroom, which made me laugh too, because I was like, that's Montreal right there in the 90s, if you were to describe that. Mark Gelina is like, I don't know, it's just light sources from downtown, don't worry about it, which is not the case, because it was there for several hours.
Yeah, it was there for close to really 3 hours, from 7:15, and it kind of disappears behind some cloud cover around 10 p.m. And
so, yeah, that's the weird thing, is that like it's described as like slowly disappearing, like it doesn't abruptly, it almost vanishes gradually.
Yes. Yeah, kind of like fading out, like somebody hit the fader very slowly, just incredibly slowly. But what's interesting is that this was not the only sighting in Montreal that night. So there is a sighting from a man, Pierre Calmartin, who definitely fits that description of pure Montreal in the 90s with the cigarette in his hand recounting his UFO sighting. But he was driving home from work between 10:30 and 11 p.m. when he saw some, quote, very odd lights, a strange luminous object in a boomerang shape low in the sky at about the level of the clouds. He described the lights as, quote, very big and strong, which
Yeah. And also to note, so he had this sighting around the Olympic Stadium, which is several kilometers for our Canadian listeners and for everyone else in the world, just America, I mean, several miles east of the downtown core.
Yes. Yes. So he drives home, and from his home, he lives in eastern Montreal. He saw this object hover near the Hydro-Québec Long Point power station. And from this vantage point, Pierre described the object as a dirigible in a way, with only kind of like the gondola on the bottom visible underneath.
Oh, you're using the cursed word. Interesting.
Yes, I know. Gondola man. Did you forget about Gondola Man? Yeah, no, he hasn't forgotten about you.
He'll see, I think, you, Rob, this is a great place to plug your Patreon too.
Yes, absolutely. If you don't know about Gondola Man, patreon.com/yourUFO guy, you will hear the Gondola Man story, which Brian was a part of. I just kind of sprung it on him.
Cursed images. Yes. And I returned the favor in that, right? So I think this is a good time to talk about this. So when I was doing research, I pulled out a book. And I'll send you a better picture of this afterwards. But there's a June 1974 sighting in Saint-Cyril, which is northeast of Montreal. And in there, essentially, the depiction of what could only be described as space or alien bees.
Yes. Yes. Think B-Girl from the No Rain Blind Melon music video. And you kind of got it. They look like, I don't know, luminous honeycombs or luminous, like that thing that you dip into the honey to pull it out. Yeah, they kind of like have that like robust center to them, and like
they're like pool donuts just stacked.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Definitely in that Michelin kind of area. Yeah. So Pierre watches this dirigible-like object. And he says he can hear this like purring or humming sound during the sighting. And he watches this thing for about 10 to 15 minutes. And the sighting occurred very close to the military base, which experienced a mysterious power outage from 11:08 to 11:50. And it's unclear what caused it. No unknown anomalies were noted, and investigators were unable to find any corroborating eyewitnesses on base that saw this object. But we know, like, the military ain't going to narc. Doesn't matter what country you're in. They're not going to narc on the UFOs. They never do.
No, no. Or the ovnis in this case?
Yeah, estimates of the UFO over the Place Bonaventure Hotel, they guesstimated to about over 1,000 feet wide that this object was. And given the altitudes of the clouds at the time, it was hovering at an approximate height of 6,000 feet at around 7:30. Like, there are points at which people say this object kind of moved a little bit, but it's kind of like shoddy there. But according to Alan Jocks, the radar operator at Dorval International Airport, he was contacted by the RCMP about a possible radar contact, though none had registered in the area. And yeah, it's just like there was an intense investigation that was conducted by Richard Haynes. And if you read the report, it's extensive. It's boring, but it's the good kind of boring that you want to see in a UFO report that's like 20 pages long, that goes into just every kind of angle that you could think of for getting as much data on this UFO sighting as they could. And they didn't really come to a definitive conclusion. They couldn't really explain it. So, you know, I think that lends a lot of credence to the Place Bonaventure Hotel incident.
So there's two authors, right? So there's Dr. Richard Haynes, who is a former NASA scientist and who has an interest in UFOs, as well as Bernard Guinette, who is a Quebec UFO researcher. And at the time was, I'm not sure at the time, but I know that he at one point was the chair of MUFON Quebec too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they get together, they put this kind of very thorough report together. And though, like you were saying, Rob, they don't draw any conclusions, it is a highly odd sighting that involves a lot of witnesses.
Yeah, it involves an excessive amount of eyewitnesses. They put it in a range between like 40 and like 75 people. And Gannett was like one of the witnesses. He saw it at like 9:30 when he was like driving around, or 7:30 when he was.
Yeah, he had left his office in Montreal and like looked up and had seen it too. And that kind of, he put two and two together when he saw. So 2 days after this, the Journal de Montréal, which is like the New York Post of Montreal, it's like the rag of like Montreal news, puts out a page one report. And so Gannett sees this and his mind kind of clicks in realizing that like, oh, what I saw was also this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if you take a look, if you start like looking at like not just the CBC piece, but a bunch of like other YouTube videos, a lot more people have commented, and I do believe it to be true that a lot more people have commented saying I saw this or I was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the number is probably in the hundreds, if not thousands, I believe, at that point.
Yeah, very fair. I mean, it's hard to get accurate. Like, you would figure in a city like Montreal, more people would have seen it than that. Than like,
yeah, but it was also November. Like, people are indoors. They're not necessarily walking around trying to take a look to see see these things.
That's fair, but also at the same time, it's not incredibly cold. Like, I think it's like what, ranging between like -6 Celsius and 0 degrees Celsius. So like,
oh, it's even warmer than that at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not incredibly cold. Like, if you live in the north, like, Brian, how would you consider 32 degrees like relatively warm for somebody who lives in the winter and isn't, you know, has lived through deep cold?
I mean, relatively for the fall and winter months, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, 32 degrees is nothing compared to January of this year when we all froze to death.
But speaking of weather, so one of the more interesting kind of explanations I saw in Christian Paget's book. So Christian Paget is a UFO investigator who at the time investigated this. And I also sent you a link to a French report on a show called Dossier Mystère, or Mystery Dossiers, that he actually put together. He had heard that a Belgian ufologist named Wim van Utrecht believed that the sighting was a mixture of light trickery as well as the formation of light columns due to the weather inherent in both, which explains the evaporative nature of the UFO, which I find interesting, but not wholly buying into that either.
Right, because the problem is that there was no immediate cloud cover when the object was first sighted. Cloud cover moved in later, but like that, it becomes problematic if you're trying to tie it into that. And like, I understand how, like, for instance, I was walking to work a couple weeks ago, and from, I don't know, like 5 blocks away, I could see this weird beam of light, and like the wind was blowing, it was snowing outside and stuff like that. And I'm like, what the hell is this like beam of light that I keep seeing? So I keep walking towards work, and I realize that out back of work, there is this
secret military installation.
Yeah, there's this totally.
There we go.
Military installation. Yeah, absolutely. There is this like, it's an outdoor light, and because of the way that the wind was blowing around the snow, it was projecting this beam of light. This like light was basically riding the snow up into the air. It was kind of cool, but like, you don't have this in this case. There's no snow. I don't think we're really in the cold territory of like light bouncing off of ice crystals at like 32 degrees.
No.
So, you know, that explanation kind of just falls flat, especially when, you know, if you're requiring at the very least some clouds in the area. Well, you didn't get clouds, really any significant clouds, till about 10:10 p.m. So, just
clear skies, not that cold, even higher altitude. I mean, like, obviously up that high, it is quite cold, but like the change in temperature would not be enough to trigger this, I don't think, from what I understand of the phenomenon. Though I could be wrong. I am not a trained scientist. I only play one on my podcast.
Yeah, that's fair. That's totally fair. Brian with the armchair expert analysis here, and I agree with him.
I will fully admit to being wrong anytime new evidence is presented to me. So until a non-Mark Gillen meteorologist comes forward and explains this to me, then I will buy into it.
Yes, absolutely. So therefore, the Place Bonaventure Hotel incident remains one of the best UFO incidents on record, and you didn't know about it probably until now. So there you go. We're educating the public. But, you know, Quebec has had a number of UFO sightings over the years. So we're going to hit you with a few of these, and it was definitely host to some of the humanoid sightings that became infamous during the 1973 Year of the Humanoids encounters. And there are a few that we're going to highlight here. I'm doing a whole episode. I'm actually recording it later this week with the guys of the Kryptonaut podcast. We're going to be like diving extensively into the report that David Webb generated in like 74, 76, somewhere around there, but it's just wild. But there is an anonymous couple living in St. Matthias de Chambly, and they're basically walking along a road not far from their residence one evening. This is in October.
October 6th, 1971. It's like after midnight and they're taking a walk. And also, just to note, so Chambly is located east of Montreal. But if you go take out a map and take a look at Montreal, you'll realize that Montreal is on a slant. So the weird thing is, all of our cardinal points are just wrong. So it's sort of shifted. So if you were to ask me where it was located, I would probably say like southeast of where I live, but that's because I'm on a slant and it's actually just like 20 minutes east of here off the island.
Yeah. So they're walking along this road and they see this bright light in a field that is adjacent to their farm. And it looks like this kind of like searchlight that's just moving all about. And, you know, without much of a thought about it, they return to their farm and just kind of forgot about it completely. You know, the next morning, this woman went outside to hang up some of her clothes when she noticed like the smoke that was rising up in the field, and she watched it for a while with these two repairmen that had shown up to make repairs. And shortly after 11:30 a.m., their attention was drawn to an object described as an upside down bowl half a mile away. The yellowish object was 50 feet in diameter, and before long, what was one object soon became two.
So one thing to note, too, is that when this woman saw this smoke column, there's no fire, which was like odd to her.
Yes, very, very odd. And there is the apathy aspect to this case in which they're definitely looking for mundane explanations to kind of explain it away. But it's just like, how do you do that in this field adjacent to your farm? Like, that's close. And like, if you see smoke, why would you not run out there and you know, to make sure that, you know, a fire doesn't spread throughout your entire farm? That seems like a smart idea. But in this case,
so just to defend that a little bit, it is the middle of fall, though it's early fall. They could be doing, like, her neighbors could have been burning leaves or something.
Yeah, that's fair. That's absolutely fair. It's tough to kind of gauge what her neighbor situation is here, because we don't get much info on that. But
well, that's the thing, is these pseudonyms or initials.
Yeah. So this small object breaks away from the bigger one and it kind of settles near a spring that's not far away. And, you know, the mundane explanation that comes to them is that it's a bulldozer moving some earth over the field. So they just pass it off. However, this explanation was shattered by the appearance of five small figures moving about the field. Now, they were Boy Scouts, and the yellow object, a large tent. These short figures appeared to be about 4 feet tall, though the tall grass did much to obscure from their vantage point, that the grass was about 2 feet tall at this point. So it obscured a lot.
Silly Scoot. It's Scouts Canada kids just wandering around the fields.
Yes. Yes.
In the middle of the day when they should probably be at school. I forgot to check what day of the week it was.
Yeah, that's fair.
Here, hold on. Let me pull up a
Oh, you're going to check it right now.
I'm doing some science here. Okay, October 1971. The 6th was a Wednesday. So there's no way that these kids are just out of school doing scout stuff in the middle of the day.
Yeah, that's completely fair. So we're poking holes in this thing. But yeah, they appeared to just kind of move back and forth between the larger and smaller objects. And with this explanation fully taking hold, all parties went back to their task, and they would kind of just glance over briefly to see if those folks were still in the area when they were, doing what they were doing. So later that afternoon, the couple's daughter came home when she heard the story of the small figures in the field. And curious, she walked out into the field and found a large circular patch of recently burned and crushed grass, 30 feet in diameter. She also found what appeared to be tracks made by a foot 6 inches wide, moving away from the burnt patch of grass. So when she returned home, she started to feel ill. She became nauseous and she had a headache. So a month later, UFO investigators were called to the site, and in addition to the burnt grass and the prints, they found these three triangular depressions 30 feet equidistantly apart from each other. They had theorized that what they had observed was a quote-unquote refueling mission, Brian. They're refueling.
They're taking our precious Earth resources away, right? Because that's the theory, is that they were here to get some water before taking off.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So additional sightings in the area did follow. So what defines the year of the humanoids is basically a couple of things. One, an excessive amount of humanoid reports, but they all seem to happen within this window from about September to early December. So this is well within that time frame. And on November 18th, 1973, near the town of Tracy, four women driving south were stunned to see a, quote, watermelon-sized ball of yellowish light suddenly appear over a pylon a quarter of a mile ahead of them. The object changed shape before their very eyes, traveling along the St. Lawrence River, which, Ryan, the St. Lawrence River is not that far from me. It's close. It's very
same,
close.
Same.
Yes.
We should boat to each other, by the way, before I forget. That should be a goal for 2022, is we'll buy boats and boat to each other.
Yes. It'll be newsworthy, I think, totally. There will be reporters covering it. And this amorphous object soon traveled in their direction, and it was following them as they were driving into Montreal. So they were met by heavy traffic, slowed down by a pink cloud that was oddly, like, they described it as laying across the highway. So
what I love about this case is the vivid colors. It's like, were these women on acid? Were they?
Right. Right. That is a fair question to ask, and it's it's plausible. It's definitely plausible at this point. Had they been dosed with LSD somewhere, I'm not sure, but it's very possible. So each car that passed through this pink cloud, they did so slowly, and once on the other side, the women had to swerve, nearly missing a man bent over on the shoulder with a large stick in his hand that resembled part of a vacuum cleaner. He was approximately 5 feet tall, wearing a one-piece dark green uniform and matching baseball cap. So another strange event that occurred in the early morning of November 21st. At 2 a.m., a woman suffering from insomnia went out to her kitchen to have a cigarette. So, definitely.
By the way, having cigarettes is very Quebecois. Like, smoking is a cultural thing.
Yeah, Yeah, totally is. It totally is. And oddly, she found like these street lights were shining into her kitchen window, only they weren't street lights. The bright whiteness of these lights kind of set itself apart. Peering out the kitchen window, she was confronted by a short, 3 foot tall, glowing figure staring at her with two large round eyes. Their head was round and shone in the darkness with a halo above it, emitting pure flame. So when you look at the image created of this creature, it looks like the Fat Flatwoods Monster, but like a more metal version that's on fire. I think that's a fair assessment of it.
So also to note, Quebec culture less so now, but like back in the day, very Catholic, right? So the idea of seeing something on fire definitely would have brought up some devilish imagery to this person.
Yeah. And oddly, this anonymous woman was not frightened of this being at all, which is very strange.
Because she knew she had sinned, Rob. The sin of cigarettes.
The sin of cigarettes, the sin of a 2 a.m. cigarette hung heavy in the air. And she just kind of found herself transfixed by the appearance of this being. So they engaged in a staring match for about 15 seconds before the figure moved away swiftly. And once the spell had ended, she ran to her sleeping husband and told him of an intruder on their property. Running outside, he failed to find anyone. There was nobody around. He failed, unfortunately.
And then he probably went home and promptly smoked a cigarette.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting to note that the local police were actually inundated with UFO sightings during that evening. So weird shit was going on. So the next case is the case of Florida Malbouf. Brian, what does her name translate to, her last name?
Bad Beef. Florida Bad Beef.
Florida Bad Beef. This case is it's a fun one. It's unique. So on January 6th, 1977, she had been suffering from a bronchial infection and was unable to sleep. I kind of wonder if she was going to like sneak a cigarette at this point.
Sneak a dart, as we say around here.
yes absolutely. As we say in the North Country, go for a rip, bud. From a third story window, she saw what she described as a quote big plate or quote large oyster.
That kept recurring, and I think it's all because they're based on the same two interviews that were conducted the days afterwards. So just to note, so she lived on Casquin Avenue, which is located in the Little Illy district of Montreal, which is kind of like smack in the middle of the city. And so she lives two blocks east of Saint-Laurent Street, the main, which is like one of the main arteries in the city.
So this is a busy area. Even at this time of night, it would be busy, right?
Yeah, I think, well, less so on her side street, but more so on Saint-Laurent probably. There are like, she's a little bit north of here, but like there are 24-hour eateries on there, right? So,
Yeah, absolutely. So this silver-colored object drifted slowly in the sky, projecting white light from the bottom, and she watched as this object disappeared over a nearby rooftop. Moments later, two figures appeared at the roof's edge. They were tall, over 6 feet in height, thin, wearing white one-piece coveralls, and their heads were covered in these tight kind of helmets. They apparently were there to kind of take in the view. They looked down at the street, they looked up at the sky, and then they just turned around and moved back to their craft. And before long, she did see this craft lift up and depart. So it really makes you wonder, what the hell were they doing? You know, like, craft lands on the roof, which we'll get to in a second. There is physical evidence in this case, or strange evidence.
I mean, there's sort of physical evidence, which makes me laugh.
Right. This incident, you know, it shook her. She was unable to sleep for the rest of the night. And she kind of just like lingered with her until she told her son, Andre, about the incident.
Andre Badbeef.
Yes, Andre Bad Beef. He's got some bad beef with these aliens now. And seeing how upset she was, Andre walked onto the roof of the building. It was across the street, and it was pretty much like an abandoned building at this point. He had kind of difficulty getting up to the roof, but he was kind of was able to make it up there. And what he found was this 20-foot wide circular sheet of ice covering a thin layer of snow. So interesting, not really sure what to make of it. Like, it's a nice looking circle. But on a separate evening, Andre, accompanied by Wido Hoville, which is the best name in UFO research ever.
Agreed.
Just a banger name. And a guy named Howard Gontovic and Paul DeBeau, two witnesses to the January 6th incident themselves, they also joined him on the roof, and they actually found these four footprints that originated from the center of the circle. They resembled the heel and toe marks of a boot, though they were very small. They were only about 6 inches long and about 1.5 inches wide, which doesn't seem like it would fit with the description of what she said, other than the fact that they were like tall and skinny. So
yeah,
it doesn't seem to fit, but given the difficulty it would take to get up there, it seemed unlikely that it could have been made by a child, but you never know. Children are resourceful and they enjoy getting into trouble. So
especially during the winter months when it's a bit colder, they can wander around more easily.
Yes.
Rob, this is a podcast first. I'm going to share a story with you of how stupid I was as a kid.
Yes, please do.
So during the winter months, it is quite cold, right? And so when I was 4 or 5 years old, I got the urge to go play cards inside of our family station wagon in the garage outside.
In the garage.
In the carport, sorry, as we call it, right? So right, my parents woke up early January morning, couldn't find me. We're freaking out, searching the house. Suddenly my dad goes outside and I had popped the back seat to lay it down. So I had like a huge flat surface to play cards with. And I was just out there playing cards for no particular reason. So obviously kids love to get in trouble during the winter months.
This has like the vibes of that hypnosis session that Leo Sprinkle did in Paul Benowitz's car when he had Myrna Hansen regress. Yeah. It has those vibes to it, right?
Only I was in my PJs, not even wearing a coat in the middle of January like an idiot.
Brian, totally not opposed to getting hypothermia as a child.
Just playing cards, man. Just enjoying my life playing cards as a 4 or 5 year old.
Yes, yes, absolutely. As 4 or 5 year olds.
So, Rob, what did they do? What did they do with this ice?
I don't even know. I didn't even find any additional information.
So Andre breaks a piece off and sticks it in his freezer. Which made me think of the infamous Jonathan Reed, there's an alien in my freezer story that like he claimed in the mid-90s. He like obviously that was very quickly debunked. But the idea of like I have alien footprints just hanging out in my freezer and eventually just like they got rid of it.
Right. Like, what do you do with a piece of ice?
Yeah. And also to note, it was early January and the weather conditions, I'm not going to say meteorological, because I'll never nail it. But the weather conditions in the area were such that a huge storm happened some days later, which really wrecked the I don't want to use the word crime scene, but the the space in which this encounter had occurred.
Yes. The encounter spot was ruined by a missing 411-esque mysterious weather event that was totally normal for the town.
Oh,
shots fired.
Missing 411. We should watch one of the documentaries sometime, Rob, together.
Yes. There I have seen both of them. The Hunters one is interesting because one of the people that went missing is from my neck of the woods, so, you know. kind of a little south, but yeah, it was interesting. It was like, oh, he's diving into the Adirondacks. Not a lot of people go missing and can't be found in the Adirondacks. We have pretty good park rangers and stuff. So,
and also Champ to help out.
Yeah, oh, Champ, like, here's the thing, folks.
Champ loves to love.
Champ loves to love. Champ loves everybody. Not only that, Champ is a private detective, and you didn't know that. But Champ can literally walk on land. Champ has been seen walking on land before. This was reported, like, I want to say in the 1800s, something like that. Somebody saw something in Vermont walk on land. Yeah, it's Champ. Champ can walk on land. Champ likes to rescue hikers that go missing in the Adirondacks. So,
a benevolent cryptid, weird, right? Like, that's just not a thing that we hear a lot of.
I know. The closest thing that we had was that weird fawn looking thing from Wisconsin. It showed worry on its face. That is the most emotive figure I've seen thus far. So, you know, cryptid, step up your game, show a little compassion, have some empathy. Huh?
Yeah, stop causing disasters. Who do we need to talk seriously to? Can I get invited to the Council of Cryptids, like, annual meeting? Like, I'm going to be under the very at the end.
I think the problem is, Brian, is that you're going to have to go back into the remote viewing training to really get to that level.
Yeah, I took a break there. I tried real hard, Rob. It was just not happening for me.
Did you come close at any point to remote viewing anything?
No, which is weird because, like, I guess I'm just haunted or whatever. But no, I did not come. No joke, I gave this an honest shot. Like, I was very curious to see. Like, I wasn't just doing this as a ploy for the Double Dynasty podcast. I actually was, like, actively being like, let me see if this is something that I can do. And it is clear that I can't.
It's a sad day when you realize that your friend has no ability to remote view anything. It's
is this the end of our friendship? Like, is this like a thing that we need to, like, figure out together?
Yeah, I think so. We're gonna have to go to.
We'll take it offline, firstly. But yeah, I'm sorry I broke your heart.
Yeah, it's okay. I think we can work it out. So, I have one more case here, and this is directly from Chris Rutkowski and Jeff Dittman's excellent book, The Canadian UFO Report. Get your hands on it. It's pretty comprehensive in, like, the most infamous UFO cases from Canada, most of which you've probably heard of. You'll get your Falcon Lakes. You'll get your Shag Harbor. Yeah, if you've never heard of the Carp Guardian case and just how wild it is, go listen to the Double Density podcast and then go read this book, because it's buck wild. I mean, honestly,
in terms of, like, the important cases, like, it is a great distillation of, like, the more important Canadian ones.
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, it's bullshit. It's a hoax, but, you know.
Oh, I thought you meant the book, not the Carp Guardian case, which is bullshit. Yes.
Yes. Yes. The Guardian case is 100% bullshit. The book is fantastic. They kind of knocked it out of the park. So,
I just wanted to make that clear because it kind of sounded like you were ragging on the book. And I was like,
no,
I know you don't feel that way about Rutkowski's work. So.
No, I respect Rutkowski's work tremendously, and I have enjoyed. We relied on him heavily for our Falcon Lake episode, so his work is solid 100% through and through. So this case, I'm going to directly quote it from the book here. Quote: "The strangeness in Canada." The strangeness continued in Canada, though fewer cases were reported on an annual basis for some time. In July 1982, outside Laval, Quebec, four young people had too close an encounter with the strange object and its occupant early one morning.
So here's the confusing thing. It's actually three young people and one older person. So it's a woman named Denise LeBure, who's the mom, and her son Francois are just kicking it outside, like, around 1 a.m. when they see strange lights and things. And so they quickly wake up the Francois' older brother, Michel, and their friend, Stéphane. So it's the three kids. And then they decide to pitch a tent outside because they saw something weird. They're waiting for something odd to happen, and it sure does.
Oh, yes. So Their attention was drawn to an object moving silently through the air. This was about 2 a.m. And with an estimated altitude of only 200 feet, the helicopter-sized craft gave off a white light powerful enough to light up the ground. After a short time, the object went behind some buildings and out of sight of the witnesses. But they were not to be alone for long. Hearing a strange noise, they peered out of their tent and saw a bizarre being, roughly the size of a human, but with orange eyes and a huge head.
Yes. So I wrote down a weird-sized, gigantic head tinged in orange. And a couple of the French descriptions are even more compelling in that the kids actually go out of the tent, turn their flashlights on, and run into this alien straight up.
Like, that is the worst. Like, why? Why aliens? Why you gotta be like up in everybody's business when you don't need to be checking out the scene? Like, give people their space. Do you not understand how unsettling you are?
Yeah, and these are like impressionable youths, teens.
Yes. And interestingly enough, they became enveloped in a whirlwind of dust, which is odd. It's very odd. And they started to experience terrible stomach pains, and they ran into the house. They didn't see anything else after this, but like,
I mean, when you're a kid, these things are exciting, right? Because your like danger centers are kind of broken. Right. Like you don't perceive fear in the same way, I guess. So it's an exciting. Yeah. And I guess the mom was like, oh, whatever. The kids can go hang. So something interesting to note, though, is that the next morning, Liberty's husband goes out into the space and he finds these like weird animal like footprints, which are described as ostrich like.
Yeah, that's very weird. Like they're basically, aren't they like three toed or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like tripod-ish.
Yes, which is three-toed prints are not uncommon sometimes in UFO reports. Sometimes people report seeing three-toed prints following a UFO sighting and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's very it's interesting. Like if you don't have any animals in the area that would cause that, like for instance, here's an interesting story. Throughout my neighborhood, in the last week or so, I saw these weird prints around. They look like they were made by a dog, but a dog with a fairly sizable paw. You could kind of see like the nails.
Are we talking Beethoven size here?
Yeah, maybe. Like it was a substantial paw, but the thing is like given the prints, it looked like it was only walking on 2 feet. Which is very weird. Like,
okay.
You would see like a succession of, you know, two prints instead of like maybe, you know, like two side by side, which you would normally see with a dog. The weird thing was this, whatever this was, walked onto my property, Brian.
What do you think it is?
I think they're keeping an eye on me, Brian, whatever they were. Either it was like a...
I want to believe that. I want to believe that they're tagging you. They're like, this guy, he knows something.
And this is what's bugging me. So we had a couple of thaws recently, a couple of days like in the 40s and one close to the 50 degrees. So there are these sets of prints that... basically walk next to my house. This is behind like a kind of like a snowbank that's melting. So I wouldn't walk there because it, you know, there's you'd have a little difficult time like, you know, walking on the snow to do it. The thing was, is there were also footprints there, which I don't remember making. So I don't know what's going on here.
Is this one of those like classic Bible stories where like there's two sets of prints, but only only one body?
There is definitely a Jesus moment. I think Jesus was carrying this dog at a certain point.
Like, let's be honest, like it was in a pouch, right? Like,
yes, totally in a pouch. It was just like weird because like I expected to see, like, if it's a dog, there should be more prints here, not just like two in a line here. So yeah, I kind of freaked myself out with that a little bit. So yeah, there's some weird stuff happening in the Adirondacks. That's just par for the course, I guess. I don't know.
I love how we went from ostrich prints to Jesus in a dog pouch. I'm very proud of us, Rob.
Yeah, I am absolutely just thrilled.
I think I could see a tear.
Yeah,
like a single tear streaming down your face.
I am. I'm about to write a bestseller here. Right when we're done.
You have threatened to write a book, which I'm like, more seriously, but like I'm waiting.
It's going to take some time, but it'll get there. It's getting there. It's writing out a timeline and like a really excessively long 3-year timeline. So, yeah, that's like 5 years down the road, but everybody will see it eventually. And, you know, I think that's a good point between, you know, Jesus pouches and books. I think it's that's the perfect ending to this podcast. So, Brian, if people want to keep up with what you're doing, where should they follow along?
MySpace.com/WeirderRadio is a great place to start. Though more seriously, on Twitter, Brian with an I, Hasty, H-E-S-T-I-E is where you can find me. I also co-host the Double Density podcast with my co-host Angelo, who actually lives kind of near where some of these sightings happen off the island. So that's kind of funny. I should check in with him to see if he's seen anything recently. And you can follow us on Twitter with @double_density and hit up doubledensity.net to find out all the different ways in which you can listen to the podcast on all the major and minor streaming platforms. And then Rob and I are also part of the Order of Podcasters, which streams regularly on Twitch. You can also find episodes all over your favorite podcasting apps.
Yes, yes, you absolutely can. As for the Our Strange Skies podcast, you can find us on most podcasting apps. For some reason, we're not on iHeartRadio. I'll get to fixing that eventually. But if you'd like to help us out, please leave a rating and review on the platforms that will allow it. Do it for the Double Density podcast. And if you're not listening to the Double Density podcast, why? Why? It's great to hear Angelo, like, you know, talk himself into the uber skeptic that he is. So
I don't even know if he's gonna listen to this episode. So this is like a great dumping ground for all of my grievances against him on another man's podcast. Like, just Angelo, yes. Like, could you read something? Like, so it's a running joke in that, like, I do sort of like more of the heavy lifting, and Angelo refuses to read and or write. Though I know he can do both. I talk to him via text. So I unless he does like, unless he's doing like a talk to text thing, which I haven't thought about actually, which might be a way that he's like communicating with me that I've just realized. But you've made him happy, Rob, in that you recently purchased a MacBook.
Yeah. I can't believe you told him. I can't believe you told him, but
I had to. It thrilled him to know, and he's brought it up like multiple times in the past week.
Oh God. Oh God.
He needs new hobbies too, not just podcasting.
So is he like Mac spotting like all over the place?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like Weir's Wall, except for real life.
Yeah, oh totally. I expect him to pop up in like my house at some point. It's just like I'm gonna see him out of the corner of my eye just looking at my MacBook Pro.
Instead of shadow people, it's just Angelo.
Yes, it explained the entire phenomenon. But seriously though, tell all your friends about the podcast that you listen to on social media and such. And if you want to support us monetarily, head on over to patreon.com/yourUFOguy, where you can learn about Gondola Man for just $3 a month. You get early access to the main episodes as well as bonus episodes. I just recorded one about this. I shared this image on Twitter a couple weeks ago, I think, at this point. And it looks like a mantis being that's getting down to Cotton Eye Joe. It definitely has like, you know, hoedown vibes. Definitely a line dancer. So if you want to hear more about that, I'll be releasing that on Patreon soon. So basically, don't be consumed by the apathy, Ray. Show the pods you enjoy some love. So if you want to hear my voice on other podcasters, Brian brought up the Order of Podcasters, which I am a part of. If you want to hear me play a George Norrie-like character, although right now I am a bisexual Southern man who plays the guitar. So, you know, if you want to catch that, you totally should. I am also the DM of Rolling Through the Realms, so please go check those out. Brian has been involved in Rolling Through the Realms too. So
it's true. It's and I've mentioned this before, but like having a leveled up character is not something that I'm used to. So it's kind of nice to just roll in and do my thing and know that like the consequences won't be as bad for my character in any form of combat.
Absolutely. He is a tank with a frying pan. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the theme song for this podcast. And special thanks to Megan Lagerberg for our fantastic logo and to the great Desdemona for our t-shirt designs. And if you want to check out some merch, there is a link in the description. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or over your local Hilton hotel.
Watch out for the ovnis.
Yes, watch out for the ovnis. In gray, we trust.
Media.